available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to this week's Outlook programme on Wednesday, the 22nd of May, 2024. In the features coming up, we continue our armchair travel through the villages of Warwickshire. We hear some tales all about Mondays. Then Nick Croft, son of one of the writers of Dad's Army, explains how having him as a dad was very much a mixed blessing. Emma Barnett tells us what a joy it is to be up at 3 a.m. to present the Today programme on Radio 4. Barry McGann then visits Blackpool, where the new museum serves as a history of light entertainment. And finally, Dave reports on this year's Earlston Festival. As well as all that, we have news from the centre and your postbag. But first, we have this week's local news, read today by Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
New jobs will be created after a battery firm launched in Coventry this week. Volclec will work with UK Battery Industrialisation Centre, known as UCBIC, to create sustainable batteries for electric vehicles. UCBIC said, "The collaboration will create jobs in the West Midlands and contribute directly to building world-class battery R&D, process and manufacturing capability in the UK." UCBIC opened in 2021 with funding from the government and West Midlands Combined Authority. It is based on the outskirts of the city near Coventry Airport and is owned by the City Council. Imran Khatri, Voltec founder, said, "Volclec has been many months and significant investment in the making, established to become help the UK's decarbonisation drive. As a proud investment in the UK, our initial focus is on the automotive industry, providing security of supply to the sector. Then we intend to look at the broader electrification markets as well." Sean Gilgan, UCBIC Managing Director, said, "We are delighted to welcome Volclec to UCBIC and to become their launch base here in the heart of the UK automotive industry. Our purpose-built facility is where businesses can develop their battery manufacturing processes at the scale they need to move to industrial production. This agreement marks the start of Volclec's journey to create a battery with the potential to scale up to significant volumes in the coming years, and we are proud to support the business in the initial phase of their development. Manufacturing cells at volume is vital to ensuring the UK prospers from the energy transition towards net zero. And this agreement further demonstrates the unique value of UCBIC to the battery ecosystem." Coventry Councillor Jim O'Boyle hailed the news that Volclec has launched. He told the local Democracy Reporting Service, "I think it's good news because it demonstrates that again Coventry seems to be the place where more and more of these businesses are coming to locate because of Green Power Park and plans around the Gigafactory." Council leader Councillor George Duggins described Green Power Park, a project that involves a West Midlands Gigafactory as its main tenant, as tantalisingly close. Councillor O'Boyle said, "These conversations are being had. I have met an investor that does want to make Coventry its home for battery manufacturing," he added, "but they still need to get their contracts in place with a customer and all the other things you'd expect them to do," he said. "In industry, it will be ready when it's ready. It's not for me to chivvy them along. That's the nature of it. I still remain very optimistic."
Green Power Park is just one of the council's priorities for the next 2 years, according to Councillor Duggins. His message in a newsletter to residents outlined what the council will focus on, with citywide elections now over until 2026, when every seat in the council will be back up for grabs. Councillor Duggins said that the need for economic prosperity is why the council has been trying to get the gigafactory and now other battery industries at the Coventry Airport site. Economic growth and prosperity is at the heart of that, as well-paid employment is proven to have clear benefits to people's housing and well-being, both physical and mental, he added. He said the council is also committed to supporting those most in need, while helping to support to provide opportunities for all to improve the lives of themselves and their families. His other priority pledges included cracking down on fly tipping with harsher penalties and more enforcement, more affordable housing, rolling out more average speed cameras, repairing roads, and changing the bin service. The council says it will also keep supporting the city's job shop and events like Godiva Festival and Moto Fest, and will plant more trees and rewild areas of the city. But Councillor Duggins said meeting all the priorities will be tough amid financial pressures, rising demand and chronic national underfunding. 3/4 of the council's budget goes on social care and housing and homelessness, he said, and the funding it gets is £89 per head below average for England. His message comes 3 months after Coventry councillors agreed huge £8.4 million cuts to services to tackle a significant gap in the council's budget. From next month, residents in the city will have to pay £40 per year for brown lidded bin collections. Council tax also went up by the maximum 5% for the second year in a row. Council tax support was reduced, and almost 3/4 of streetlights across the city will now be turned off overnight. Yet, despite the savings, the council's budget in February still showed a £14 million deficit for next year. It remains to be seen exactly how the council will be making more tough choices on services next year to try to close that gap.
Offices will be torn down and student accommodation will rise in its place after a controversial planning decision by Coventry City Council. But Coventry residents are split on the decision. Land in Westwood Business Park can be used for student housing as part of a re-gearing of the lease, and a new 544-bed building is expected for the site. A recent report suggested that there was too much student accommodation currently in Coventry. One building has applied to be able to rent out to non-students after their 322-bed scheme was only two-thirds full during the last academic year. A local protest aiming to call in the decision was rejected on the grounds that it would delay the construction by a year and deny the council improved income in the meantime. Conservative councillor Marcus Lapser was the sponsor of a petition against urgent approval and said that if it was called in, whatever the decision is, the local community can be assured that the correct steps of scrutiny worked. One Coventry resident commented, "The presence of students in the city is of great financial significance, as they contribute substantially to the local economy. It's Coventry, not Lower Manhattan. Lucky we have the universities." Another agreed, "Housing students near to the university is freeing up general housing bought as HMOs. Best build for the students and ban HMOs in the area. Students bring in a lot of disposable income, supporting many shops and businesses. The NIMBYs need to remember universities are business." But others disagreed. "The population of Coventry is rocketing because of these students. They may bring some economic benefits, but the disadvantages outweigh the advantages. A public inquiry must be held to examine the ridiculous amount of student accommodation continually being built. Building student accommodation really is never-ending. But logically, there has to be a final figure. Common sense dictates. University of Warwick are literally taking over Canley and Westwood. To just ignore the concerns of locals and reject the requirement for review, and also in an era where student blocks are sitting without full capacity on the basis of apparent extra revenue, is concerning.
Coventry University has risen through the rankings of a prestigious league table of the world's young universities. Listing the world's best universities that are 50 years old or younger, the Times Higher Education Young University Rankings is based on 18 performance indicators grouped into five areas: teaching, research environment, research quality, international outlook, and industry. Coventry University has been ranked joint 165th across the world with an overall score of 44.3. International outlook, which is defined as the ability of a university to attract undergraduates, postgraduates and faculty from all over the planet, was the highest performing category for Coventry University with a score of 95.6. Professor John Latham, CBE, Vice-Chancellor of Coventry University and Chief Executive of Coventry University Group, said, "We are delighted to be recognised for the significant improvements that have been made and for everything we have achieved in the last year. Our leap in the rankings is testament to the hard work and dedication of our staff, who are key to delivering our mission of creating better futures. I'm particularly delighted to see that our work in the area of international outlook has been recognised. We deeply value both our wonderfully diverse student community, which across the world, across the group, is made up of 162 nationalities, and our work across the globe. Two subjects taught by Coventry University ranked in the top 10 across all UK institutions. Health studies moved up one spot to 6th, and paramedic science also moved up one spot to 10th. There were four additional subjects, all in the top 20. Nursing and midwifery, information technology and systems, counselling, and psychotherapy and occupational therapy. Coventry University was also honoured with one of the last awards ever approved by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, in the form of the Queen's Award for Enterprise, for its tireless work building relationships with institutions and companies across the world, while also drawing thousands of students from around the globe to its campuses across the UK.
A time capsule has been opened earlier than planned, after the village hall it was resting under had to be demolished to make way for the HS2 railway line. The capsule in Burton Green near Coventry was due to remain underground for years to come, but it was recovered during the demolition process and opened inside the new village hall built by HS2. Cheryl Wall, chair of trustees at Burton Green Village Hall, said, "I think the letters from the children were particularly moving, as they brought back memories for people. You could see them reacting to some of the things as they came out of the time capsule that they remembered, people and what was going on at the time." A letter written by a 7-year-old boy, who will now be 49 years old, I wonder if he was there, shared an insight into the cost of a first-class stamp, which the letter said cost just 15p at the time the metal box was buried. Helen Lloyd, who was a brownie back in 1982 and now leads a brownie pack, said opening the time capsule brought back a lot of memories. "When I was just looking through it, there was all the badges that we used to do. I had an amazing time in brownies. It was such good fun." A new time capsule was buried underneath the new village hall in 2022, and it is hoped it will remain undisturbed for longer than its predecessor.
Coventry Council will spend an extra £1.6 million on a project to do up an empty school so a new one can move in. It means Woodfield School will be able to move into the old Woodland School site in Eastern Green, which shut in 2017. Woodfield School will take on more pupils, meaning fewer children will be forced to travel outside the city due to a lack of specialist places. The costs for the project have soared, and councillors agreed extra funding last week. As well as inflation, one reason for the higher costs is complexities with the design and refurbishment of what is a listed building. 10 blocks built for the 1950s school are Grade 2 listed. Council Director of Property Richard Moon said that this listing makes life much more difficult than it would otherwise be. Without this, the council would likely to have opted for a cheaper new build for the school, he said. But Mr Moon agreed Historic England has allowed the council to demolish some of the school buildings, and the groups have reached a compromise. He also said Historic England is there to do a job, and they would argue they're doing the right thing in preserving buildings for future generations. Is it ideal? Not in all circumstances, no, but it's an issue we just have to deal with, he added. The listing, made in the early 1990s, described the school as an early purpose-built comprehensive, constructed with a steel frame and precast concrete panels. Changes to the council scheme for the site's refurbishment include replacing roofs, strengthening work, and more fire protection measures. The decision means Woodfield School will avoid delays converting to an academy. The school is currently split across different locations and is the only specialist provider for children with social, emotional, and mental health needs in Coventry. It is set to move to the site in Woodlands in late 2025. Cabinet Member for Children, Labour Councillor Patricia Seaman said, "This is Coventry at its best, doing its best, listening to our families and making things happen."
A youth worker who helps vulnerable refugees and asylum seekers has been given the Royal Seal of Approval. Syed Taher from Coventry's Positive Youth Foundation runs the Duke of Edinburgh Award Programme for Marginalised People. Syed joined the Positive Youth Foundation, based on Puma Way, 3 years ago, and helped implement the Duke of Edinburgh Award there. It takes a minimum of 12 months to complete, with activities in 5 sections: physical, skills, volunteering, a 5-day residential, and a 4-day expedition. Syed said, "I realise my passion for aiding young individuals, driven by my own experience that, due to my background, lacked support. Introducing the Duke of Edinburgh's Award to our young people has been transformative. It's provided them with a sense of community, purpose, and facilitated their integration into their new environment. Witnessing the transformation, growth, and empowerment they experience through our programmes is incredibly rewarding." He was among guests invited to a festival-style celebration at Buckingham Palace. Here he spoke to Prince Edward, the King's brother and current Duke of Edinburgh, to tell him of his work. As well as honouring volunteers, the celebration also recognised more than 8,000 youngsters who have achieved the Gold Duke of Edinburgh Award. It had giant deck chairs, bunting, garden games and activities. Syed said, "Meeting the Duke of Edinburgh was an absolute surreal experience. The opportunity to interact with someone of such distinction and hear his words of appreciation for our work at the Positive Youth Foundation was truly humbling. His genuine interest and gratitude left me feeling incredibly honoured and motivated to continue our efforts in empowering young people."
Two fast-growing Coventry and Warwickshire firms have been recognised in this year's King's Awards. RYSE 3D and Arrowsmith Engineering were both honoured for their outstanding business achievements. Mitchell Barnes, founder of Shipston-on-Stour-based RYSE 3D, is one of the youngest managing directors to receive one of these prestigious awards. His business, specialising in 3D printing, began with him replacing his mum's washing machines in the garage with DIY 3D printers to create models at university. 7 years on, His firm employs 14 people and has just completed a £1.5 million investment drive. It's now supplying 3D printed production parts to 18 hypercar projects across the world. Coventry-based Arrowsmith Engineering picked up its award in the international trade category after an export sales boom. It has seen overseas sales rocket by nearly 400% after being in the depths of despair following the pandemic, and orders now account for 35% of the firm's annual £7.6 million turnover. Precision components manufactured at Arrowsmith's Baton Road factory in Coventry are sent to customers in China, France, Germany, Singapore and Spain for end use in aerospace engines, landing gears and airframes. After a focus on recruiting female engineers, women now make up nearly a quarter of the company's workforce. Managing Director Jason Aldridge said, "It's been some turnaround from the very depths of despair during COVID to the renaissance we are seeing now and in the future. Civil aviation, a major market for us, literally dropped off the cliff," I think he means metaphorically, "with the pandemic, and we had to show good old-fashioned resilience and a fair bit of business innovation to get through it." He added, "The King's Award will definitely help us with recruitment, especially when you consider we are competing with some major car makers and aerospace primes locally. The process is one of the most stringent in business, and I'm delighted for our wonderful staff."
Coventry music legend Frank Ifield has died. The iconic singer, dubbed the city's most successful recording artist, died peacefully in his sleep in Sydney, Australia, at the age of 86 on Saturday night. The singer, who is honoured in the city's Music Wall of Fame, was born in Cowden in November 1937 to Australian-born parents. His father was an inventor who created the Ifield pump, a device used in fuel systems for jet aircraft, and the family returned to Australia when Frank was three. But he did not forget his roots, and during the height of his fame made frequent appearances at the Coventry Theatre. Frank had four UK number one singles in an era when being number one in the charts guaranteed stardom. He also famously helped to launch the Beatles' career, having them open for him. It exposed the Liverpool Quartet to his massive fan base and helped kickstart their careers. He made a visit back to his home city in 2013, where he visited the theatre as well as his old childhood house before visiting the Wall of Fame. His friend Glenn A. Baker, a music historian and journalist who shared the heartbreaking news on social media, posted, "There is so much to be said about this remarkable man who had four number ones in Britain, three of them before the Beatles, who he had briefly supported in concert. I Remember You became an indelible hit all around the world and a perfect signature song. It topped the UK charts for 7 weeks, selling more than 1 million copies, and later hit number 5 in the US. Frank Ifield developed a passion for country music and yodeling after moving from Coventry to Sydney with his Australian-born parents. When he received a guitar from his grandmother at the tender age of 13, he taught himself to play and started penning songs. I had my guitar with me at school one day, and the headmaster encouraged me to adapt Australian poetry to my own tunes and then perform them to the class," he later recalled. By the time he was 19, he had already released an incredible 44 records and was the top recording artist in Australia, New Zealand and Tasmania. He made the move to London in 1959, where he went on to become an international sensation after scoring three number one hits on the UK singles chart. I Remember You, Lovesick Blues and The Wayward Wind, making him the second ever artist after Elvis Presley to score three consecutive number one singles in the UK.
A festival of classic and modern performance cars is set to return to Coventry to celebrate its 10th anniversary. Motorfest Coventry offers a non-stop cultural celebration of the city's motoring past, present and future, organisers said. Free events are being held across the city centre on the 1st and 2nd of June, with some activities based at the Transport Museum. More than 200,000 people are expected to attend, and visitors can experience racing simulators, go-karting and a giant Scalextric track. There will be a full-size replica of the Bloodhound Land Speed record car, alongside the simulator that will enable people to experience driving a Le Mans endurance racing car or the Thrust SSC Land Speed car. James Noble, the festival director, said the event attracted people from around the country. "We had no idea how Motorfest would land or whether it would be received well and whether it was what the city wanted," he said. "But Motorfest is what it is today because the brilliant, brilliant population of Coventry has embraced it." He said there was a lot of new technology for people to try, as well as looking back at the city's motoring heritage. The Scalextric track will feature some of Coventry's notable landmarks, and, along with DJs performing, visitors will be able to use a viewing platform to overlook track action. Mr. Noble concluded, "For our 10-year anniversary, Motorfest Coventry is celebrating with its biggest ever entertainment programme, a non-stop cultural celebration of the city's motoring past, present and future."
A Coventry NHS trust has become the first in England to deliver a new treatment for Parkinson's disease to one of its outpatients. Seamus Connolly, who was diagnosed with the disease in 2013, recently began pro-duodopa treatment at University Hospital Coventry. The treatment, which involves wearing a portable kit, was recently approved for use by the NHS, and uses a small automatic pump to steadily release medicine into the bloodstream. Laura Tia, consultant neurologist at University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust, said it was exciting to be able to offer the new therapy to patients. "The team worked very well once we knew Proadupa would be available in the UK, and it's an honour to be the first centre in England to start this therapy in an outpatient setting." Produodopa is a combination of two drugs, Foslevodopa and Foscarbidopa, and works by turning Foslevodopa into the chemical dopamine, helping to transmit messages between parts of the brain and nerves that control movement. This helps to manage symptoms of Parkinson's disease, external, a condition in which parts of the brain become progressively damaged, causing tremors, balance problems and slow movement. Patients can administer an additional dose when needed, offering greater personal control, UHCW said. Mr. Connolly said, "The immediate difference is that I don't have to take lots of tablets throughout the day, just a few in the morning. I then change the syringe and I'm good to go. I used to have to think about everything, where I went, if I could make it home. But now I have confidence and hope for the future." His wife Maria said, "We have four grown-up sons. For them it feels like they've got their dad back, and for me it feels like my husband is back." Nearly 1,000 patients could be eligible for the treatment as the drug continues to be rolled out across the country.
Outlook News.
Well, many thanks to Elaine and Peter. Now, we have a couple of announcements. First of all, sunrise will be at 5 o'clock and sunset will be at 5 past 9. As well as that, we've got a short note for Brenda. Brenda, sorry you didn't get the stick 2 weeks ago. Your wallet had not arrived back and we couldn't send you one. Also, last week's programme, I don't know what went wrong with your stick, so we will include last week's again this week. Hope that's all right. Right then, so We now have you with all the news from the centre.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Welcome. It's nice to have a new faces to look at. Now, I've got quite a lot to tell you. I told you quite a lot last week, and I'm going to tell you quite a lot this week. Some of it the same quite a lot as last week. Don't forget, next Wednesday, we've got the Showdown Tryout Day, Have a Go Day, which is going to be taking place here at the Resource Centre. So it's Wednesday the 29th of May. It's going from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. and it's an opportunity just to come and have a go at the game. There'll be some teas and coffees and refreshments and other things around. If you know, in between times, because not everybody can play all the time, but you can certainly watch, and it's a bit of a social event as well. So we'll be looking forward to seeing you there. Well, Chris will be, and then whilst we're still on Showdown, a whole month later on the 29th of June, that's a Saturday, there's the Showdown first national tournament with all the new teams. This is taking place at Warwick School and it's going to be an opportunity to obviously to have another go, to take part in a competition, to learn how to coach if that's what you're interested in, be opportunity for referees to have a go, and there'll be some training for players as well. So there's lots going on that day, and I think, you know, if you're at all interested in Showdown, definitely go along to that. Well, I mean, go along to that, talk to Chris or somebody at reception, either Heather or Carol, and they will get you into that event.
So, excuse me, on Showdown, presumably you, by your position in the centre, have had a go at Showdown.
I have.
And how did you find it?
It's absolutely fantastic. it's such good fun. It's noisy. I'm going to be putting some sound baffling technology into that room because it is really noisy, but you're banging a ball from one end to the other. Everybody's wearing blindfolds.
Yeah.
You've got gloves and protection, and the idea is just to basically get your ball into the other person's goal.
Well, it's like air hockey.
A cross between air hockey and table tennis, really.
Ah, but you can't see it on
you
this
can't
occasion.
See it. You can't see. You've got to make use of your other senses. Everybody who's played it has had a fantastic time.
Did you feel that you credited yourself fairly well?
Well, in as much as I did, yes. I was playing opposite Chris, and he was, you know, I thought we were fairly evenly matched. But, you know, I've had a few goes, and it's just fun, and it's noisy, and it's raucous and loud, and that's kind of good. So we're just going to look at some things that just happened very recently. So on Sunday we had the Move for Fun up at the War Memorial Park, and Peter was there with quite a good number of the walking group as well, raising money for the centre and with, you know, it's a bit of sponsorship come in. If you can still an opportunity to throw money at us to sponsor the walking group who did the Move for Fun. I just want to single out Gemma Booth, who comes to the centre fairly regularly. Now, Gemma did the full 5K Move for Fun. This was the day after she did her first ever 10K in the Race for Life. Not everybody will know Gemma, but she's, you know, definitely on a fitness kick at the moment, so she's trying to get a lot fitter and losing weight, and she's just doing amazingly well, and she is so impressive to watch her. So, you know, Gemma, you know, I said this to you in person the other day, but, you know, I'm saying it in front of everybody now, you know, we're so proud of what you're doing and how you're doing it. It's you know, you're an inspiration, so, you know, keep up the good work. The music group, last Monday, they went to St James's Church in Tile Hill and performed for the group there. They've been there before and has always had a good time. Apparently there was one lady who got up and was dancing away. They absolutely love it. So the group is certainly going to go back, and that raised a very welcome donation of £75. So thank you very much to St James's Church for that. I say the music group will certainly be going back for that. Now, in terms of other fundraising things, we've got the inflatable 5K coming up in July, and I did have the date written down, but I can't remember what it is. We're still looking for one more person. 27th, thank you, Peter. 27th of July for the inflatable 5K. We're still looking for one more person to take up the ticket that we've got and to get sponsorship. So the inflatable 5K is basically a 5 kilometre run with added bouncy castles, and it's a lot of fun. We want people to get out there and raise money for the charity and have a good time as well. So I'm not expecting some of you dear people out in listener land to want to do that yourselves, but you may have youthful members of your family who may well be up for it. Talking about youthful members of significant people's families, Jack Mitchell, who's Rosie's grandson, he's taking part in a marathon in Tallinn on the 6th of September, entirely for the resource centre. It's going to be his first ever marathon, so that's an amazing challenge event. So we'll be promoting that, more and more as we go over the summer. You can already donate to him. He's already raised something like £600 on Just Giving. If you can go through our website our Facebook page, and you'll find Jack's marathon in Tallinn on there, and you can contribute already if you wish to do so.
Ah, but tell the listeners where Tallinn is, because I didn't know.
It's in Estonia. I've been there. It's a lovely city. It's like mini. It's like low rise and big river running through it. It's a very nice city. I enjoyed it there very much. Talking of challenge events, there's one really major challenge coming up for one of our people here at the centre. Many of you will know Jo Proctor, who now runs the charity shop, and she's in craft group and creative writing and all sorts of things. She did an awful lot for us regarding the Poppy event last November as well. And many of you will know that she really does like to talk quite a lot and quite loudly. We love her. Her challenge, which she has accepted on the 17th of July, is to stay silent for 8 hours. This is going to be almost impossible, but anyway, we are keeping our fingers crossed. We're going to be promoting this quite a lot on the Facebook as well, because we think this is really quite a funny old challenge. It's going to be such a task for her, and she's determined. She's been practicing. She got up to 25 minutes the other day.
It is
a place to start. Yeah, until a robin distracted her and she said hello. So there we are. So you see where she's at with it. So that's on the 17th of July. A few days before that, on the 13th of July, which is a Saturday, we've got our summer garden party. That is a little advance notice for you. That'll be afternoon tea in the garden. I'll be getting up very early that day and making scones by the dozen, and there'll be cake and lots of lovely sandwiches, etc., etc. So lots of good things going on that day. We're also going to be entertained by the Yukaholics, who are coming, so it should be a really pleasant afternoon, providing the weather stays good. Last year the weather did not stay good, and we had to come inside, and it was a little bit crowded, but anyway, we will see. We'll keep our fingers crossed for this year. Sort of jumping forwards and backwards in time here, so I do apologise, and trying to sort of group it in things of interest. I mentioned last week, I will mention again, there is a theatre trip going to take place on the 25th of June, which is a Tuesday. Normally go on a Wednesday, this is going to be a Tuesday, and it's to come down to the Criterion to see The Homecoming, starring, well, moi, actually, as it happens. So you get the opportunity to see me play a really grumpy, angry, very unpleasant man. It's slightly funny, but if you've got that sort of a dark sense of humour. Anyway, tickets, as usual, are £12.50, plus the bus, which is £6 return, if that's how you choose to do it, plus fish and chips. So you can leave your name at the centre. There'll be a touch tour in the afternoon at 5 o'clock, down to the theatre, have a grope around the set, and if you really have to, possibly a grope around me, and then yes. Only my costume, perhaps. And then we're going to... then we'll be back up here for fish and chips before coming down to the theatre in the evening. I will join you for part of that, but not all of it. Right. Claire, as you know, is our community fundraising champion, and she's organising a few lovely events. She's helping Joe with the Sponsored Silence and Jack with his marathon and the Inflatable 5K and various other things. She has now also organised a rum and reggae night, which is going to take place at the Cottage in Earlston, and that's going to be on the 9th of August. Now, the Cottage are doing this as a fundraiser for us, so they're not charging us, but we're charging you. If you want to come, and it'll be open to the general public, and this is a special treat sort of one. It's not like, go on then, because it's going to be 40 quid for the ticket. Yeah, but out of that, you'll get, like, a lot of rum and quite a lot of reggae. And, you know, after a few of those rums, you...
Yo-ho-ho.
Yes, exactly, yo-ho-ho, and you really won't care that the ticket cost you 40 quid, and you might have had a really good time. We're hoping to raise about £1,000 for the charity from that. So if you're interested in that, do let Claire know. We'll get tickets sorted out later, but that one will be open to the general public as well. So rum's the coming thing. It was whiskey, and then gin has had its day, isn't it? But rum, apparently, you know, that's really getting up there, and there's lots of really good rums out there. So if you like your strong liquors, then and you fancy learning a bit more about rum, then that is the night for you. So, just going into what's happening a little bit at the centre here, we're having a little bit of an office change around. Denise, who's been here forever and does our accounts and everything like that, she is moving from upstairs to downstairs. So now she is going to be in the office in Boston Lodge, so the library office. When you go in the Boston Lodge door, first door on the left, she's sharing that office with Cudi. Joe is going to move into what was Denise's office, so that so she'll have an office on her own there, and then Claire will remain in the office where she is at the top of the stairs right at the end, as and when we get more staff coming in, which I hope to do so, then they will go and share that office with Claire. So the fundraising department is still upstairs, so there's a bit of a shift round. It doesn't make any difference to their telephone numbers, which all move with them. So if you need to talk to anybody, just call up. You'll go through the list of options that we have when you're first confronted with... confronted, that's not the right word, isn't it? When you phone up, welcomed by, yes, me, as it happens, and again, I do everything here. Anyway, you can go through on their numbers there. And one last thing, next week is half term. So we're not open on it's bank holiday on Monday, so we're not open on Monday. So if you're expecting to come in for a group on Monday, unexpect. And then next week, Cudi is going to be off all week, so she works Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, so she'll be off. Denise is going to be off next week as well, and I'm going to be off on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday next week. For me, bank holiday. Obviously off, Tuesday I'll be in, and then Wednesday to Friday I'll be off. So if you desperately need me next week, Tuesday is your only day. And I think, dear friends, it's probably enough. There's quite a lot going on these days, so we're looking forward to seeing you in due course.
Well, thank you, and as ever, there's no shortage of things going on by the sound of it.
Certainly not.
Well, finally, I think we'd all like to wish you the very best of luck when you play that grumpy old man.
Oh, thank you very much. I need to learn my words first.
From news here at the centre, we normally move to Sarah with sport. But as you know, she's had an operation on her wrist, so is away for this week, but plans to be back next time. So, in place of a usual report, we're going to be finding out about a controversial report that the Olympic Games, starting next month in Paris, originated in Shropshire, and not Athens, as we all thought. Or so says Jan Johnson in this article from This England, read by Elaine.
The Olympic Games, founded at least 3,000 years ago, was first documented as taking place in 776 BC at Olympia, southern Greece, although contests existed long before that date. They continued until 393 AD, when Roman Emperor Theodosius I, a Christian, considered them pagan and abolished them. As we know, centuries later, in 1896, the Olympic Games were revived in Athens. But just how did William Penny Brooks, a medical doctor in the small town of Much Wenlock in Shropshire, come to be recognised as the inspiration behind their return? Brooks was born on the 13th of August 1809 to Jane and William Brooks. His father was a local doctor, and the family home a six-bedroom terraced house at 4 Wilmore Street in Much Wenlock. The eldest of six children, at age 15 he was apprenticed to his father, later going on to further his medical knowledge in the combined London hospitals of Guy's and St Thomas's. In 1829 he travelled to Paris to continue his studies, remaining there for a year before going on to Padua in Italy with his brother John. In 1831, at the age of 21, receiving the sad news his father had contracted typhoid and died, he returned home to Much Wenlock, where he immediately stepped into his father's shoes. By then he had qualified as a doctor. His practice covered the town and surrounding districts, meaning that he sometimes rode up to 70 miles a day visiting patients. Brooks was diligent in all he undertook, devoting his life to improving the lot of the society in which he'd been born. In particular, he campaigned rigorously to get sports and physical exercise included on the school curriculums, believing them to be beneficial for a healthy body and mind. Serving the community as a doctor, surgeon, social reformer and justice of the peace, he learnt much of the living conditions of the poor and threw his energies into involving himself in many civic tasks. It was in 1841 that he founded the Wenlock Agricultural Reading Society, specifically to give the working classes in the area a chance of improving their lot. A lending library was set up with classes available in music, botany and art. In later years, the classes moved to the Corn Exchange, built in 1852 as a market space and reading rooms, another project for which Brooks both campaigned and raised funds. In October 1850, the Olympian class was founded, and it was decided immediately to stage sports contests, to be held annually in the town, to promote the moral, physical, and intellectual improvement of the inhabitants of the town and neighbourhood of Wenlock. Later in the same month, the first Wenlock Games took place. The competitions proved popular and went on in later years to attract several thousand participants and spectators from much further afield. At first, the annual Wenlock Olympian Games consisted of a variety of athletic events, but included also were traditional country sports such as cricket and quoits. There was even an old woman's race and a wheelbarrow race to keep the spectators amused. The events were held on the Linden Field, and competitors were preceded through the streets of the town by a herald on a white horse, a band, and waving flags. At the time, it was only privileged young men from the upper classes who were allowed to enter sports competitions. Brooks, however, a firm believer that all men were equal, opened his games to all. For the first time, competitive sports in Britain saw both rich and poor competing against each other. Initially, the idea was met with disapproval. Allowing the working classes to participate, it was said, would lead to riots, drunkenness and lewd behaviour, and men might even leave their wives. Despite the doubters, the Wenlock Games went on to be highly successful. By 1860, the Olympian class had left the auspices of the Reading Society and renamed itself the Wenlock Olympian Society. It's still in existence to this day. One year later, in 1861, Brooks set forth a new idea, the Shropshire Olympian Games, to take place every 2 years in different towns around Shropshire. At this time, he was writing frequently to the Greek authorities, urging them to consider reinstating Olympic-style games. Sadly, due to the domestic situation in Greece at the time, he was not successful. In 1865, Brooks was involved in setting up the National Olympian Society with John Hulley and Ernst Ravstein. Their mission was to establish a union for different Olympian, athletic, gymnastic, boating, swimming, cricket, and other similar societies. The Society's first event took place at Crystal Palace in 1866. Open to everyone, more than 10,000 spectators attended. It was in 1889 that the young Baron Pierre de Coubertin, philosopher and organiser of the International Congress on Physical Education, appealed in British newspapers for support for a revival of the International Olympic Games. One of the replies he received was from Brooks. At the time, he was still pressing for a revival of the Olympic Games in Greece, and seeing an opportunity, he invited the Baron to visit Much Wenlock. He also wanted to discuss the importance of exercise, something the French government had asked the Baron to investigate whilst in Britain. The Baron arrived by train, and in his honour, a special Wenlock Games was held on October the 22nd, 1890. By then, Brooks was in his 80s, but still full of enthusiasm for his idea of reviving the Olympic Games, explaining in great detail his ambition to see an international competition once more taking place with all comers accepted. On his return to France, the Baron spoke enthusiastically of Brooks's dream in an article printed in the Revue Athletique, writing, "If the Olympic Games that modern Greece has not yet been able to revive still survive today, it is due not to a Greek, but to Dr. W.P. Brooks. It is he who inaugurated them 40 years ago, and it is still he, now 82 years old, but alert and vigorous, who continues to organise and inspire them." What the Baron witnessed during his few days in Much Wenlock undoubtedly planted the seed of once more reviving the Olympic Games, and in 1894, 4 years after he had visited Much Wenlock, the Baron went on to found the International Olympic Committee. 2 years later, in 1896, the world celebrated its first modern-day Olympic Games in Athens, Greece. Sadly, Brooks died on the 11th of December, 1895, at the age of 86, just 4 months before the first Olympics took place. During his long life, Brooks had worked hard for the community, and to celebrate his life, a memorial tablet was erected on the Corn Exchange. In grateful remembrance of William Penny Brooks, the pioneer and lifelong advocate of physical education, to whose individual and unselfish efforts Wenlock owes the construction of her railways, the restoration of her Guildhall, the foundation of the Olympian Society, and the erection of the Corn Exchange. This tablet is placed here by public subscription in the 60th year of the reign of Queen Victoria, 1897. In 1994, the then president of the International Olympic Committee visited Much Wenlock and standing by Brooks's grave in the churchyard said, "I came to pay tribute and homage to Dr. Brooks, who really was the founder of the modern Olympic Games. This year will be the 137th Games arranged by the Wenlock Olympian Society, along with Wenlock Olympians Athletics Club. Events taking place on July the 2nd will include athletics, encompassing the long jump, discus, shot put, races, and the pentathlon, and a 7-mile road race. Other planned sports during the duration of the Games include archery, bowls, equestrian events, quick cricket, swimming, and netball. How very proud Dr. William Penny Brooks would be if he could see his vision, not only of the forthcoming International Games, but also the much Wenlock Olympian Games continuing to this day."
A different slant on sport for this week. So back to normal with Sarah next time. Now let's hear your messages for this week in Dave's Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there. Welcome to your Postbag. I'm speaking to you from Birkenhead Park. I'm having a birthday holiday with my two sons, Paul and Graham, and I was jiving on the dance floor of Smokey's Bar in Liverpool last night, and now we're in Birkenhead Park, and it's really beautiful. I'm just leaning on the wall of a Roman boathouse, and in the distance is a Swiss bridge. It's a lovely lake, and it's designed for you to get the feeling that you can travel around the world in Birkenhead Park. Lovely. Let's get on with Postbag. Bob Sine is telling you how to save money on your water meter.
I'm talking about different things with Graham saying about the water meters. I'd just like to confirm I save about £500 a year. I've had my water meter fitted about 5 years ago, and I was told I'd save £450 to £500. So you know you're taking that off me without me using that amount of water. And I was told, well, it's up to you to get a water meter. I said, right, it was fitted within 3 weeks, and that's over five years ago now. But thank you very much anyway, Doreen and John, for sending your messages about my loss. Let's just keep our fingers crossed that I don't have to wait too long. It's dreadful when you're on your own and you can't get out, although my cousin takes me different places, shopping and things like that. But it is what it is. Take care, everyone. Oh, yeah, I would just like to say, 32 years when you were on about Doreen, about me, Jubilee Crescent. I was a fundraiser there with Community Broadcasting and the chairman on and off at times. And at the Resource Centre, I was the fundraiser manager. So that CBS must have been going almost or just over 50 years now, according to my maths. Anyway, Dave will know. Okay, all the best, everyone. Take care. Bob Sine.
Well, I'm back home now, and there was some really helpful information from Bob. Thank you, Bob. And if you're on your own, especially, you could save hundreds of pounds by having a water meter fitted. So please think about that seriously. And now we've had lots of water recently, and it makes the grass grow. Here's Julia's report entitled, "Keep Off the Grass." I have a part of a large communal garden at the place where I live. We have a team of gardeners who do our grounds. This week they mowed the lawn, which is half the size of a small mountain in Wales. It's not all my lawn. The other residents have their own tennis courts. Anyway, what do you think the gardeners did when they had cut our grass? They only left the grass behind, littering up the place. What do they think we're going to do with a load of grass? My friend John said we should smoke it, but Wendy the warden had other ideas. She said we should clean it all up, and she gave us all a patch of grass, a broom, a dustpan, a brush, and stood over us, looking menacing. So that's what we had to do. Of course, I couldn't see the grass, but that didn't stop Wendy the warden. Get on with it, she shouted. Use your fingers to feel the grass. If there's any left at the end, you'll get 14 days washing up duty. She used to be such a nice lady, too. If anybody needs a gardening expert, drop me a line and I'll see what I can do. The answer lies in the soil. Lots of love, Julia. Thank you, Julia. The meanest thing I know about Wendy is her demon services when she's playing table tennis. I was asked by your friend Joanna at the bereavement group to make sure I went dancing last Thursday as the Gateway Club were having a plant sale downstairs. So, just after I came back from the holiday, same evening, I gate-crashed the room full of ladies, including Wendy, and brought some plants before going back upstairs to do the Mayfair quick step and the barn dance, etc. The night after I jived on the floor of the Liverpool bar on my 78th birthday, Paul, Graham and myself sang as the Mad Monks at a folk club in Bromborough in the Wirral. We sang a gospel song, Mary, Don't You Weep. And now here's Doreen with a birthday greeting for me.
Hello, this is Doreen Hilton again. I've just had a very nice phone call from Dave Monks, our postbag. He's told me it was his birthday on 14th of May. Well, I'd say he was a naughty boy for not telling me. But never mind, we'll laugh and smile about that. So anyway, Doreen is going to do a little song for you. Here we come. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dave. Happy birthday to you. And God bless you, my love. Many more. Okay.
Thank you very much, Doreen. That was lovely. And finally, here's Edwina to talk about Stoneleigh Abbey's connection with author Jane Austen.
There is a very important person, if it is, or was, involved with Stoneleigh Abbey. If you remember our wonderful writer, Jane Austen, there was a connection to the family. He played belonged to a cousin of her mother's, and it meant that when he died, the mum and some of the other family gained. But the very interesting part of the history is the connection with Jane Austen, because she regularly went to stay at Stoneleigh Abbey. So part of the house is still as it was when Jane was there. We were shown something that she had actually touched or used, and the room she used. We went into the private church that she used. It was so very, very interesting. And you felt as if Jane was going round with you. There was so much warmth and history. It was a really lovely trip that everyone enjoyed. So Stanley Abbey is a very historical place to visit. We enjoyed it. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. And for your messages this week, I mean, please let's hear from you next time. There's loads of ways you can talk to us. Send us a message in Postbank. You can phone that number. 024-76-717-522 and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper. Or you can send a letter, either written by you or on someone on your behalf. Or you can even phone me up if you want. 024-76-598484. Or send me an email if you want. davidmonks@hotmail.com. Right, anyway, but as long as it's something you feel happiest in doing, but we'd love to hear from you. So, thank you very much, and bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's another week's postbag from Dave. Do keep those contributions coming. We now continue the series looking at Warwickshire villages with Elaine. And this week, the village is Baddesley Ensor.
Turn off the A5 Watling Street at Grendon and you are going back in time. For this old turnpike road leads to Coles Hill and Baddesley Ensor stands en route up the hill. In 1848, Baddesley's ancient church was pulled down and replaced by the Church of St. Nicholas. The old pulpit was bought by the Wesleyan Methodists and installed in their chapel. This five-sided black pulpit is claimed to be the one from which Bishop Latimer preached nearly 400 years ago. The same bishop was burned at the stake by Mary Tudor, saying, "This day, by God's grace, we have lit a candle in England which shall never be put out." Baddesley seems always to have had a rebel tradition. In 1669, Quakers were considered rebels, and their meetings declared illegal. But they had a secret meeting house in Baddesley. In 1772, when the Quakers were given freedom to worship, Baddesley Quakers built a meeting house of their own. The Quakers used the building until 100 years ago, at which time it was rented to the Wesleyan Methodists. Up until 1931, Quakers from many parts of the Midlands made an annual pilgrimage to Baddesley. The Wesleyan Chapel is now no longer used. The Trinity Church stands on Keys Hill, where it was opened in 1863. There is a large common adjacent to the middle school. The school was opened in the 1930s, initially catering for pupils of all ages, but senior pupils now attend school elsewhere. On the last Thursday in July, before the school broke up for the holidays, the children would walk in class formation to Merivale Hall, where tea would be served to them in the park. After tea, races were organised, after which Lady Dugdale gave and presented the prizes. Finally, the Dugdale family would sit and listen to the well-rehearsed songs by the children. For several years, the senior girls dressed in white and performed country dancing, accompanied by a teacher on the violin. At the end of the festivities, as the children left, they were each given a currant bun and a bag of sugar fondant sweets, which cheered them as they wended their way wearily but happily home. This event was terminated at the beginning of the Second World War and has never been revived. The first school stands at the end of Maypole Lane in a delightful rural setting. Baddesley Colliery opened in 1850 and was closed in 1989. It provided employment for many of the male population. Originally, it was owned by the Dugdale family of Merivale Hall, before being taken over by the National Coal Board. At present, both Baddesley Enser and Grendon are joining to fight a plan to start open-cast mining in the area. The Baddesley rebel tradition lives on.
Next week, Elaine will visit Barford. A lot of people aren't too keen on Mondays and back to work, especially after the lovely weekend we've just had. But work isn't the only thing about the beginning of the week. Estella brings us some tales all about Mondays.
The names of our months are all of Roman origin, but the days of our week derive mostly from Old English words, four of them called after ancient Norse or Scandinavian gods. So where do we start? Well, up until 1971, Sunday was billed as the first day of the week, until in that year it became the last, the day of rest, and Monday got officially promoted into first place. It seems that in the year when we switched to decimal currency, we also went in for adjusting the calendar. Can't say I was ever aware of this major surgery to our week. I suppose I was too busy learning to think in new pence and mourning the passing of the shilling. Monday is named after the moon, which was worshipped as an important goddess by ancient peoples. Time was measured according to its phases, and month comes from the same word. Saint Monday, also Cobbler's Monday, was a jokey name given to the day because it was once observed by shoemakers as a holiday. Holy day, get it? Never mind. The story goes that while Oliver Cromwell was encamped at Perth in Scotland, one of his most loyal followers, called Monday, died, and Cromwell offered a reward for the best lines on his death. A shoemaker wrote the following: "Blessed be the Sabbath day, and cursed be worldly wealth. Tuesday will begin the week, since Monday's hanged himself." Heaven knows what the other verses were like, but Cromwell granted this poet the reward and also decreed that shoemakers should be allowed to make Monday a standing holiday. Years ago, of course, before the days of the automatic washing machine, Monday was traditionally wash day. As the old rhyme goes, "They that wash on Monday have all the week to dry." I can just remember my grandmother's dolly tub and my mother's much more up-to-date gas copper. The job took all morning, before a lunch with cold meat cut from yesterday's joint. "'Twas on a Monday morning," the song says, "as I beheld my darling," etc., etc. "She looked so neat and nimble o'er washing of her linen o," and so on through the endless chores of the virtuous woman's week. After the washing came the mangling. Mum's mangle was a streamlined version which could be clamped to a tabletop. When my brother was small, Mum acquired her first twin tub machine. Gran was appalled by such extravagant laziness. How could this newfangled item possibly get the clothes so clean? Until, that is, she fell in love with the new spin dryer my parents bought her. Those of us working outside the home have all experienced that well-known phenomenon, the Monday morning feeling. Back to the grindstone we go, to greet the leave-it-till-Monday in tray, containing all those items we passed over with relief on Friday. A colleague of mine, who liked to go in for serious living it up at weekends, used to take most of her leave in Mondays, so her presence in the office on that day tended to cause comment. Those of us who crammed household tasks and gardening into our weekends couldn't believe we were back in harness, feeling so little rested. "Tell me why I don't like Mondays," wrote Bob Geldof in a song for his group, the Boomtown Rats. And one day he sang it to the world when his Live Aid concert brought in millions for the starving people of Ethiopia. Perhaps this universal dislike of Mondays is the reason why so many public holidays were made to fall on that day. Were you born on a Monday? Well, congratulations, Monday's child is fair of face. If you married or plan to marry on that day, great. Wealth should be yours. Oh, and it's okay to cut your nails on Monday because you cut them for health. But try not to sneeze because you sneeze for danger.
So, it's not all doom and gloom on Monday. I'm sure everyone remembers Dad's Army at Warmington-on-Sea, and many have probably been watching the television reruns. It was Nick Croft's father who was the genius behind the wonderful scripts, but for Nick, it was something of a mixed blessing. This article, taken from the Daily Express and written by Richard Barber, is read by Keith.
As the son of the TV genius behind the Warmington-on-Sea, Home Guard, Heidi High, Hello Hello, and a host of other classic comedies, it is only now, at the age of 70, Nick Croft feels he is finally emerging from his father's shadow. By his own admission, Nick Croft enjoyed a gilded childhood. As the eldest child of comedy genius David Croft, who created television gold with a string of copper-bottom sitcoms, everything from Dad's Army to Hello, Hello, from It Ain't Off Opmum to Heidi High, and from Are You Being Served to You Rang My Lord, life was fun and money was never short. Along with his three younger brothers and three younger sisters, he enjoyed what, by any account, sounds like a highly entertaining, glamorous upbringing, which involved rubbing shoulders with many of the biggest British stars of the era. But it is only now, at 70, that he can admit, it's taken this long to strike out on my own, to come out from under the shadow of my father's fame. He'd always written songs for his own amusement and had made music with one of his brothers, John. At one stage, they even had a studio in London's Camden Town. But that was for other people to make demo discs, so we'd attract Neil Young's cousin or Mark Bolan's son, Roland. They had a lot of fun, but we were overtaken by the digital revolution. People were choosing to make demos in their own bedrooms. There was no need for a studio. Along the way, he recorded demos of his own songs, but just recently, he started a new chapter, releasing his first solo album of his own material. When I began writing in the late 70s, I was already influenced by James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, singer-songwriters. But by the end of the decade, punk had become fashionable, then dance and rap, and I got left behind. As it is, he says, he's still writing songs that hark back to the sound of the late 70s. His first album, Beyond Why, out now digitally and released on vinyl later this month, features the lead single, Love Is Too Small a Word, best described as where soft rock meets country. It's easy listening, and no apologies for that. Everything else is so hard. It was recorded at Peter Gabriel's Real World Studios in Bath. I'd only ever written songs to be played on guitar or piano, or sometimes both. I'd never arranged them for a band, and they sound fantastic. Getting it heard by a wider world is now the challenge. It's not easy to get on radio student stations' playlists. Even though I'm 70, I'm a complete newbie. For many years, I have been and still am involved in my father's life. He had such a large volume of work from the late 60s to the early 90s. Nor is Nick complaining. I was very happy to be known as David Croft's son for 50, 60 years, but his work was of such a high quality that even as a youngster, when I was developing and singing songs like Always a Woman or Your Song, I was never encouraged to make a career out of it. The truth, he confesses, when pushed, is that he was actively discouraged. My parents used to tell me to get a proper job. I was in finance for a bit, trying to make rich people richer. It was a lucrative business, but not good for the soul, not nourishing. It took me 5 years or so to discover that. He tried a mix of decorating, landscape gardening and street theatre. Anything to put food on the table for the family. He has two children, David, named after his father, and Elena. At one stage, he was British Frisbee champion. He chuckles, rather a niche achievement, I will admit. With his sisters, he ensures the continuation of their father's business. It's still going on now. We're still shipping merchandise and tapes of Dad's Army around the world, to Spain, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, anywhere there are expats. There's demand for other shows too. Urang Milord has achieved cult status in Hungary. Who knew? Last week, two people wanted to do a cookbook in Hungarian based on that sitcom.
And Keith will conclude that article about Dad's Army next week. For many people, the Today programme on Radio 4 is an essential start to the day. But those who present the programmes are up much earlier. And news presenter Emma Barnett says what a joy it is to be up at 3 a.m. and on the air early, as read by Sue.
3 days ago, it was Today Day in my house. That's not some weird new way of saying ta-da to our 16-month-old. No, it was something I've been working up to for several months. My first shift hosting the BBC's Today programme on Radio 4. Today is a 3-hour programme with many elements to get comfortable with, so I've been rehearsing a couple of days a week for a few weeks. I've also been reading a lot. Today covers all different aspects of life, and so, despite already being a news junkie, I upped my intake even more. This had a twofold effect. It gave me some decent and quite diverse chat around the dinner table to anyone that would listen, although a 16-month-old and a 6-year-old are a pretty tough crowd, and a few ideas to pitch from day one. Of course I had some nerves. I was about to do something new, and radio is a weird job, regardless of the show, because you have an audience. In this case, a rather large one. But at the same time, it wasn't new. I have 15 years of live radio under my belt. I've taken 2 maternity leaves and come back each time to make work I'm proud of. Today is created by a strong and welcoming team, and I find myself quickly getting into the zone, feeling the fear and doing it anyway, to paraphrase the best-selling author Susan Jeffers. When it was announced that I was joining the show, a stalwart of British breakfast radio, there was a flurry of warm messages from friends, family and listeners. But there was another reaction that no other job move has prompted. Concern. It goes roughly like this, and is still going 2 shifts in. Oh my gosh, how are you going to cope with those early starts? What time do you have to set your alarm? Then the questioner pulls a face like they've watched a cat eat its own vomit as I answer, 3:05 a.m. in the cheeriest voice I can muster. A swift reply follows, rather you than me, or I've done shift work, make sure you nap. And that's it. Conservational cul-de-sac reached. I've never had a reaction about a job change before that comes laced with such concern about my personal life. It's quite touching, but it also has shades of the reaction I sometimes elicit when certain people find out I'm an only child. These folk look at me as if I've been dealt a terrible hand, their faces etched with a mixture of concern and pity. I don't always have the energy to disabuse them of their views, but I'll tell you, it was blimmin' marvellous, and I don't know any different. But back to the new job. Concern over my new 3 a.m. starts is more understandable, and it is safe to say I was in denial about this element of the role while in prep mode. How do you prepare for the alarm going off at a time beginning with a 3? I asked some veterans of breakfast broadcasting and a couple of farmers in my life, a great combination, and the answer is, you can't. They gave many amazing tips about blackout blinds, when and when not to drink caffeine, and what sleep-inducing supplements to take. But ultimately, you just have to suck it up. In fact, the best three pieces of advice I received respectively from two broadcasters and one dairy farmer were, don't hit the snooze button, it never gets easier, so just get the hell up, and do not complain to anyone about being tired, it's bad chat and you've got an amazing job. Quite. The night before my first show, I completely failed to heed the other bit of advice and got to bed unusually early. I eventually managed to fall asleep at 10:30 p.m. after lots of reading and turning my political interview over in my mind, the first 8:10 a.m. slot of my tenure. I couldn't quite see the structure of it yet, but I was nearly there and nodded off, dreaming of Westminster. My first experience of waking up at 3:05 a.m. felt like being pulled out of a deep lagoon. I didn't understand what or why this was happening. Then it hit me. I had a new job to do, and it starts now. I jumped up, splashed cold water all over my head, whacked on some blusher and concealer, and pulled on the clothes carefully laid out the night before. I didn't want to wake the two children and my husband, who woke up specially to whisper, good luck and go get 'em, from his side of the bed, before promptly and wisely lying back down. So I waited until I got outside our front door, quietly closing it at 3:25 a.m. before I took a deep breath. It's safe to say there were not a lot of people up and about. I felt wired, and like it was pretty transgressive being up at that time. I also felt a bit nauseous pre my first brew of the day, which I drank at 4:30 a.m, having gratefully received it from one of our lovely producers, as I worked my way through the running order, writing scripts in the office, sat next to my co-host, Amol Rajan. On my second morning, when close to the BBC, I spotted three beautifully dressed young women, armed with tripods, portable lights and phones, marching with purpose. As they honed in on a traditional red phone box, I realised that they had decided to use the quietness of this 3 a.m. land to stage a photo shoot in London's deserted streets. Genius! I was listening to some Led Zeppelin on my newly minted morning playlist as this wonderful sight unfolded. The riffs seemed the perfect backdrop to their creative use of time and resource. But back to my first shift. Before I knew it, there were just 5 minutes to go until the red light went on and I said the words I'd heard others say hundreds of times over the years. Good morning. It's 6 o'clock. You are listening to Today with... Except this time, my name was in the mix. I also added in, what a pleasure it is to be here, because I meant it. Truly. Nothing beats the moment a show starts, because my favourite people are suddenly involved. Our listeners. Radio for me is always a conversation with them. They are my North Star. Yes, those first few moments were surreal, but having flashed a smile at Amol and shared a grin with my new editors sitting on the other side of the glass, we were off and away. And weirdly, I felt like I'd come home.
It's certainly not my choice to be up at 3 o'clock. Blackpool is famous for its lights and entertainment, which is celebrated in the new Blackpool Museum, which records the history of light entertainment. Barry McGann visited the museum and wrote this article in the This England magazine. It's read by Elaine.
For over 150 years, Blackpool has been renowned for its attractions, fresh air and fun. Some say it has an entertainment heritage rivalled only by London's West End. But one question visitors have been known to ask is where Blackpool's museum is. Well, now there is one, virtually next door to Blackpool Tower, and it is called Showtown. Billed as a museum of fun and entertainment, the venue has been 10 years in the making as a project by the Blackpool Heritage and Museum Trust. The Trust was formed in 2015 and made up of local councillors, members of the community and champions of the resort, which is where Barry McCann comes in. Over the past decade, he has been one of a team of local historians researching the resort's cultural history. His own pet projects have included the Wakes Weeks, which served as a cradle for Blackpool's growth as the workers' playground, through to entertainers who performed in the town, including Lenny Henry, the Grumbleweeds, and the legendary Coco the Clown. He assisted in hosting promotional events for the museum, mainly in Blackpool's Winter Gardens, which was the originally planned home for the venue. The feedback from the public at these events helped shape and evolve the museum into the form it has now become. Not a static exhibition, but an energised experience that would be colourful, enjoyable and unforgettable. All this work comes to fruition in March of this year, with Blackpool-born Alfie Bow cutting the red ribbon, accompanied by the legendary Blackpool Tower Circus ringmaster Norman Barrett and master magician Paul Zennon. The entrance heralds a colourful staircase leading up to 6 interactive galleries, a panoramic 15-metre-long screen with animated images of Blackpool's seaside culture, of donkeys, seagulls and sideshows, heralds the opening section. It's complemented by a full-size Punch and Judy tent, complete with puppets, for visitors to stage their own shows. For those nostalgic for the traditional boarding house landlady, there is one hanging around to engage visitors in her own brand of banter. The House Tricks Gallery celebrates the likes of Tommy Cooper, the escapologist Murray, who ran his own magic shop in the town, and Sooty, who Harry Corbett first bought from a stall on Blackpool North Pier in 1948, and has now come home. There are also interactive magic tricks for visitors to try their hand up. Roll Up, Roll Up showcases sparkling clown costumes on loan from the V&A in London and never before seen on display, along with props, vintage posters and footage of performers at the Tower Circus over its lifetime. There is a special place for Charlie Caroli, arguably Blackpool's most well-remembered clown, while the present Tower Circus incumbent Mookie speaks to visitors from a dressing table mirror. A resident ring mistress is also on hand to entertain and inform. Variety Heritage is the subject of its showtime, including Little Titchy's Boots and George Formby's Banjo. The Illuminations Gallery also offers a behind-the-scenes look at the greatest free light show on Earth and a chance to design your own illumination. As the Tower Ballroom is the spiritual home of Strictly Come Dancing, the Everybody Dance Now section celebrates this heritage from ballroom to Northern Soul. There is a wall that allows you to pop your head through and integrate with projected bodies going through different dancing styles. The museum will host talks and presentations, and a donation from the Sir Ken Dodd Foundation will create a dedicated learning space to educate children in understanding Blackpool's entertainment history. Showtown is open daily from 10 till 5, and admission for visitors remains valid as a 12-month pass.
I've only ever been to Blackpool once, many, many years ago, and even then I didn't see the illuminations, which by all accounts are well worth a visit. Entertainment and a good day out near our home was at the Earlston Festival 10 days ago, when the weather fortunately stayed dry, and the centre here was very much part of it. Dave, of course, was there to record this report.
Hello there, big welcome to the Earlston Festival. And I'm just walking up to the resource centre now, and there's lots of stalls in the car park. Well, the first lady I'm speaking to is Baby Rashi, and can you tell me about your stall?
So, I work as a secondary school maths teacher, and I'm here to promote my tutoring business.
Wow.
And I am going to do the maths, English and science for the 11 plus exam, yes. The grammar school exam, and the primary and the secondary as well. So, if anybody is interested, just give me the call.
So are you giving extra tuition at home?
Yes. No, it's not home. I open a centre in the Mary Magdalene Church in the Chapelfield, and one I'm going to start in the Albany Theatre from next week.
Oh, excellent. Okay, I'm speaking to a gentleman on the Blue Angel stall, which sounds intriguing. What's your name?
My name's Chris.
Okay, can you tell me about Bluebird Care, please? Is that based in Earlston?
It is, yes. So our office is just off the High Street in Earlston, yeah. And we provide kind of home care services for the over 18s in Coventry.
Okay, is that home care at home or is that home care in the home?
So in individuals' homes.
It's home care, yes.
Yeah, so in individuals' homes. So we work to try and keep people safe and warm in their own homes, so yeah. An alternative to going into a care home.
That sounds absolutely great. Thank you very much. So how do you contact them?
So you can give us a call on our telephone numbers at 02475263300, or you can send us an email, customercarecoventry@bluebirdcare.co.uk.
Okay, that's Bluebird Care.
That's right, yes it is.
Okay, right. I'm at the Earlston Festival in the car park of the resource centre. I'm speaking to Roger Bailey, who's a former St George who came to the Monday Club once. Okay, what do you think of the Earlston Festival?
I love the Earlston Festival. It's a beautiful day, the sun is shining, lots of people out having a good time. Yes. Recycle a lot of goods at your centre.
Yes.
So we've got some Lego sets going for auction shortly, I love Lego.
Yeah.
And got plants, you've got lots of glassware. It's great to see it being recycled and raising money for charity.
It is.
It's not been thrown away.
Yeah. That's excellent. Mm. Okay, thank you, Roger. Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, Earlston Street is absolutely packed with people, with stalls all the way down Earlston Street. And here is a green man. And he's playing a curious form of bagpipes. Hello.
Well, I'm the wild man of the woods. I live in Earlston. I've been the wild man of the woods for 34 years.
Yeah.
I paint myself green, and I dress all in green, and I've got a crown of green leaves on my head, and jingle bells. And I go up and down the country to all kinds of events, often community events like this, and play me old English bagpipe, sing songs, tell stories, and generally be entertaining, you know, and green. Green, 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 wonderful green.
There's lots and lots of stalls. There's one for the Two-Tone Village, where the Coventry Music Museum is. And here we have the Morris dancers. Morris dancers, fantastic. What's your name?
My name's Martin.
Can you talk about the origins of one or two of your dancers, please? Are they local, the villagers?
Good question. The history of the Morris is lost in the mists of time, basically. Most of the dances we're doing today are from a village called Ascot under Wychwood in Oxfordshire.
You're not too far away.
No, not too far. This style of dancing seems to have settled in the South Midlands.
Yeah.
We know them as Cotswold dances. Yeah. So when they were collected at the beginning of the 20th century, they were mainly collected in Oxfordshire, Gloucestershire, a little bit of a spread into Northamptonshire, Warwickshire, South Warwickshire. So, local-ish. It's more a local style than any of the other styles of Morris that are about, and there are a few.
And here's the Hooker Duck Stand, with lots of plastic ducks swimming round and round that people have to hook with a rod. Yes, I'm speaking to Sipperary, outside Elston Methodist Church. You once came to the Monday Club and sat outside in the garden.
Them. Yeah, I used to speak to you people when I used to come there. When I was minister here at Elston Methodist Church.
That's it. Yeah. Okay. So what are you selling here on your stall?
Well, we are selling lots of things because we started a charity here at Elston and the members of the church were supporting it. So when I retired, I went back home and said, you have to do something to support yourselves. So they are making loads of recycled things, elephants, rhinos, hippos, butterflies, giraffes, little key rings, we sell them, flowers, they are making so many things.
You started an orphanage in Zimbabwe, was it?
That's right. It was actually started by some of the members who helped me when I told them the stories of the poor orphans in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, and that was a fantastic thing that you did. Thank you very much, Sipperary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I've just bought a hippo made from a Fanta orange can by the orphans in Zimbabwe that Sipperary founded. That's wonderful. And with the sound of the Day Spring Steel Band, we say bye-bye to the Elston Festival.
And that report from the Elston Festival brings us to the end of another edition of Outlook. So, from me, Ashley Hayward, and all the Outlook team, it's goodbye for another week.